This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. On March 26th of 2016, my poetry series, the Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, had a very special evening. We celebrated with Dana Gioia, who is our new California State Poet Laureate. And as part of that celebration, not only was Gioia there, but two Sonoma County Poetry Out Loud participants, Arthur Timpe and Sarah Condello, recited poetry. And Daniel Redman, who has spent years writing original musical settings for Whitman's Leaves of Grass, was also there to perform. The celebration took more than an hour, so I can't air the whole thing on tonight's program. I've done a little editing, and you'll hear just as much of it as possible. So sit back now and enjoy Dana Gioia, Arthur Timpe, Sarah Condello, and Daniel Redman. I'm Catherine Hastings, and I'm the host of the Word Temple Poetry Series, and we have a wonderful, wonderful evening planned ahead. We are here to celebrate the appointment of Dana Gioia as our new California State Poet Laureate. This is great. We have a very full evening ahead, so in order to keep things moving at a good pace for you, I'm going to introduce three guests right off the bat before Dana even gets up here. And they are going to be performing poetry and song in a type of braid. They're very excited about doing this, and they want to do this in honor of Mr. Gioia. I know we'll all enjoy it. The three are Daniel Redman and two participants of the Poetry Out Loud recitation contest, which Dana started when he was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. The two students are Arthur Timpe. He is a junior at El Molino High School. His passions are listening to music, playing golf, and performing in the theater arts department. He hopes to become a professional golfer someday, and to continue his career in theater. Sarah Condello is a sophomore at Annalee High School right here in Sebastopol. She is very passionate about writing, and she wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. And then Daniel Redman. For the past 10 years, Daniel Redman has been composing and performing original music settings set to Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. An essay on the Poetry Foundation website says that his songs are similar in tone and rhythm to cantorial music. The words that a cantor slows down to stress might be God's name or hallelujah, while the words of Whitman that Redman stresses are used to describe fervent emotions toward lovers or the desire to welcome all people across time within his embrace, to create a society in which difference is acknowledged, imagine, and welcomed. So tonight you will hear just a sample of those songs. Arthur is going to come up first, and Daniel will weave his songs in between the two students. He'll recite two poems, and Sarah will also recite two poems a little later on. So please welcome right now Daniel Redman.
To begin this evening, I thought the new poet laureate of California, the future of poetry in California. There's a Whitman loved talking about all the different states and all the different regions and the geography and the topography, but he's got one I think that's especially fitting for this evening. This is a promise and a gift to California.
A promise and gift to California, also to the great pastoral plains, and for again sojourning years, a while longer, soon I travel to American love, for I know very well that I and robust love belong among you.
playing is Arthur Timpey, and today I will be performing Aria by David Barber. What if it were possible to vanquish all this shame with a wash of varnish? Instead of wishing, the stain would vanish. What if you gave it a glossy finish? What if there were a way to burnish all this foolishness, all the anguish? What if you gave yourself leave to ravish all these ravages with famished relish? What if this were your way to flourish? What if the self you love to punish, knavish, peevish, wolfish, sheepish, were all slipped up into something lavish? Why so squeamish? Why make a fetish out of everything you must relinquish? Why not embellish what you can't abolish? What if the true worth of the varnish were to replenish your resolve to vanquish every vain wish before you vanish? My second poem I will be doing is called Cool Tunes, written by Carl Sandburg. When Abraham Lincoln was shoveled into the tombs, he forgot the copperheads and the assassin in the dust in the cool tombs. And Ulysses Grant lost all thought of con men and Wall Street. Cash and collateral turned ashes in the dust in cool tombs. Pocahontas' body, lovely as a poplar, sweet as a red haw in November and a pawpaw in May. Did she wonder? Does she remember in the dust in the cool tombs? Take any street full of people, buying clothes and groceries, cheering a hero, or throwing confetti and blowing tin horns. Tell me, the lovers are losers. Tell me if any get more than the lovers in the dust, in the cool tunes.
For this final poem that I wanted to share, this is from the 1892 version of Leaves of Grass from the Inscriptions chapter. And I think a lot of Whitman's project involved reaching to the past, finding his own connection to that history, to that unbroken tradition, and at the same time reaching forward to the present, into the future. Pardon me, reaching forward to the future, reaching forward to us, and those to come after us. And I think that is at the root of a lot of the power of his project. And some poems make that attempt on his part to reach forward even more explicit, and this is one of them. It's called Poets to Come. Poets to come, orators, singers, musicians to come, not today is to justify me and answer what I am for, but you, a new brood, native, athletic, continental, greater than before, known or rose, for you must justify me. I myself but write one or two indicative words for the future. I but advance only to wheel and hurry back in the darkness. I am a man of sauntering along without fully stopping, turns a casual look upon your end, then averts his face, leaving it to you to prove and define it. Expecting the main things from you.
Hello, my name is Sarah Candello, and I will be reciting For the Young Who Want to by Marge Piercy. Talent is what they say you have after the novel is published and favorably reviewed. Beforehand, what you have is a tedious illusion, a hobby like knitting. Work is what you have done after the play is produced and the audience collects. Before that, friends keep asking when you're planning to go out and get a job. Genius is what they know you had after the third volume of Remarkable Poems. Earlier, they accused you of withdrawing. Ask why you don't have a baby. Call you a bum. The reason people want MFAs? Take workshops with fancy names when all you can really learn is a few techniques, typing instructions, and somebody else's mannerisms. Is that every artist lacks a license to hang on the wall like your optician, your vet, proving you may be a clumsy sadist whose fillings fall into the stew, but you're certified a dentist. The real writer is one who really writes. Talent is an invention like phlogiston after the fact of fire. Work is its own cure. You have to like it better than being loved. And my next poem is Try to Praise the Mutilated World by Adam Zagajewski. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world, and the gray feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns.
That was fun, wasn't it? That was really nice. All right. It is hard, if not impossible, to imagine a better person being made our next California State Poet Laureate than Dana Gioia. It had to be a real easy pick, in my opinion. Many of you have heard him recite his poetry before, perhaps right here at Word Temple when he was reading and performing with Kjell Efsmark from Sweden. It was an incredible evening. Gioia, a Stanford Business School graduate who claims to be the only person in history who went to business school to be a poet. He's the former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He has published 5 full-length collections of poetry, 8 chapbooks, and as a critic, the infamous Can Poetry Matter, which is also over on the table tonight. That book created a whole lot of dialogue and was also a finalist for the National Book Circle Award. He has a new essay that was just published by Wiseblood Books, and it's not here tonight, unfortunately. It's called Poetry as Enchantment, and it is absolutely enchanting. You have to get this. So you can go to, I think it's wiseblood books.com to check it out, or you can email me and I'll tell you how you can get it also. It's just wonderful. He has edited many literary anthologies, including 20th Century American Poetry, 100 Great Poets of the English Language, and others. His poems, translations, essays, and reviews have appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post Book World, the New York Times Book Review, Slate, and the Hudson Review. Not a bad list. And if that isn't enough, he's also written 3 opera libretti and is an active translator of poetry from Latin, Italian, and German. As chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, he succeeded in doing something that seems utterly impossible right now. He got bipartisan support in Congress. We need to go back there, friend. And for what? For the mission of the Arts Endowment itself. Business Week magazine referred to him as the man who saved the NEA. He created lots of incredible programs when he was serving in that capacity. I encourage you to go to his website, which is danajoya.com, to learn about all of these programs. Some of them include Shakespeare in American Communities, Operation Homecoming, Poetry Out Loud, the National Recitation Contest, The Big Read, which I know a lot of you have participated in, and more. He served 2 terms as chairman of the NEA because, you know, how else was he going to get all of this done? So he left that position in 2009. In 2011, he became the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture at the University of Southern California, where he teaches each fall semester. And the last time he read here, he read from his book, Pity the Beautiful, which is just an astonishing collection. Tonight we will hear him recite from his latest collection of poems, 99 Poems New and Selected. This book was named one of the best new poetry books by the Washington Post in February of this year. So now it is time to welcome Dana Joya.
Good evening. I want to say that Catherine made one tiny mistake at the very beginning, and that she said that Arthur and Sarah and Daniel had come in honor of me. Arthur, Sarah, Daniel, Phyllis, Catherine, everyone here has come in honor of poetry. And that's important because poetry is not an art people understand well today, but it is the most ancient, the most primal art that humanity practices. It goes back before the invention of writing. It is one of the things that allowed us to become human. And I think it's most powerful when it is in its primal form, which is speech heightened to the level of music. What Daniel did this evening is what the original poets did. I think that all poetry was originally sung or chanted, and that's what meter is. I once had a Shakespearean actor said that, the teachers always say that iambic pentameter is da-dum, 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 da-dum. But what it really is it is the heartbeat of the poet, which in the course of the poem has our hearts synchronized with it. It's a physical connection. And, poetry has become very intellectualized in our culture, but that's not the basis of poetry, which is a kind of holistic form of human communication, which addresses us in the fullness of our humanity. It addresses us as creatures who think, who feel, who see, who remember, who imagine, who intuit. And it does not ask us to divide that into pieces. Now, we may have to divide the intellect off for us to do physics. We may have to, in a sense, divide the rhythmic capability in some ways to do dance. But poetry speaks to us and expresses us in the wholeness of our humanity. I thought I would read or recite a baker's dozen of poems this evening. And I wanted to start with one that takes place in Sebastopol. Actually, the very first time that I ever came to Sebastopol. I'm from a town called Hawthorne, down in L.A. It's a neighborhood of southwest L.A., very rough, working class, completely urbanized neighborhood. And there really are no open spaces in Hawthorne, hardly any trees in Hawthorne. And when I was in college, I drove up north with a girl I was in love with, and we stopped in a town I didn't really know at that point with the odd name of Sebastopol, little thinking that my parents would actually move there in a few years. And we got out, it was in April, and we walked through apple orchards. You remember when Sebastopol had apple orchards before the vineyards moved in? And it was the first time that I'd ever really had a sense of what the natural seasons were. And I wrote this poem. I wrote a couple of lines. It took me 23 years to finish the poem, The Apple Orchard. You won't remember it. The apple orchard. We wandered through one April afternoon, climbing the hill behind the empty farm. A city boy, I'd never seen a grove burst in full flower or breathed the bitter, sweet perfume of blossoms mingling with the dust. A quarter mile of trees and fragrant rows arching above us, we walked the aisle alone in spring's ephemeral cathedral. We had the luck, if you can call it that, of having been in love, but never lovers. The bright flame burning, fed by pure desire. Nothing consumed, such secrets brought to light. There was a moment when I stood behind you to reach out to spin you toward me. But I stopped. What more could I have wanted from that day? Everything, of course. Perhaps that was the point. To learn that what we will not grasp is lost. Now, I'd like to back to Hawthorne, which does have a few cultural distinctions, one of which is that the Wilson family live there, as in Brian Wilson. Now, interestingly, and this tells you everything you need to know about art, Hawthorne was not on the beach. the beach was an imaginary, was several steps away. And this is about growing up in L.A. In the 60s, but it's really about how when you hear an old song, it has the power to bring you back to who you were and what you were when it first was on the radio. This is about hearing a song years later. I guess I should say one thing to explain this. Nowadays, if you talk about the best popular music of the 60s, you always mention the Beach Boys. I mean, they put the Beach Boys on the cover of the New Republic, for God's sake. But, think back to the 60s, no intellectual could possibly have admitted he liked the Beach Boys. It was a love that dare not speak its name. So you sort of need to know that for this one. Cruising with the Beach Boys. So strange to hear that song again tonight. Traveling on business in a rented car. Miles from anywhere I've been before. And now a tune I haven't heard for years. Probably not since it last left the charts. Back in L.A., in 1969, I can't believe I know the words by heart and can't think of a girl to blame them on. Every love-sick summer has its song, and this one I pretended to despise. But if I were alone when it came on, I tuned it up full blast to sing along, a primal scream in a croaky baritone, the notes all flat, the lyrics mostly slurred. No wonder I spent so much time alone, making the rounds in Dad's old Thunderbird. Some nights, I drove down to the beach to park and walk along the railings of the pier. The water down below was cold and dark, the waves monotonous against the shore. The darkness and the mist, and the midnight sea, the flickering lights reflected from the city. A perfect setting for a boy like me, the Cecil B. DeMille of my self-pity. I thought by now I'd left those nights behind, lost like the girls that I could never get, gone with the years, junked with the old T-Bird. But one old song, a stretch of empty road, can open up a door and let them fall, tumbling like boxes from a dusty shelf. Tightening my throat for no reason at all, bringing on tears shed only for myself. I wrote a sequence in my first book that was written in the voice of, or in the style of, a daily horoscope column, where it tells you what's going to happen to you. It's in the second person. It's very intimate, and, you know, talks about this. And this is about, there comes a moment, all these things happen. This is the one poem where, don't worry about the stars. And I now read it, because whenever anybody writes about me, they always quote this poem and say, this is what his theme is, and, which was news to me. But I think they're probably right. The stars now rearrange themselves above you, but to no effect. Tonight, only for tonight, their powers lapse, and you must look toward Earth. There will be no comets now, no pointing star to lead where you know you must go. Look for smaller signs instead, the fine disturbances of ordered things, when suddenly the rhythms of your expectations break, and in a moment's pause, another world reveals itself behind the ordinary. And one small detail out of place will be enough to let you know. A missing ring, a breath, a footfall, or a sudden breeze, a crack of light beneath a darkened door.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Ward Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Dana Gioia.
Now, this is another early poem. It should be no news to you that probably anybody who writes poetry probably needs analysis. And I mean this with all due respect to Marge Percy. And there's nothing that drives you quite so crazy as trying to put together your selected poems. And I decided I was going to choose 99 poems out of a great, you know, several hundred. And I began picking them, which became a kind of madness. It's kind of like a little, it's like having conversations with imaginary friends. And I didn't want to organize it chronologically because, I mean, frankly, do you care what order I wrote my poems in? No, of course not. I mean, you got your own lives to worry about. And so I decided to try to give people different doors. And so I divided the book into seven compartments or seven rooms: mystery, place, remembrance, imagination, song, story, and love. And this is the first one in the place. And this is a poem I wrote. And when I wrote this poem, I was living back east, and I heard somebody talk about having gone up to California. And they said, well, what was it like? He says, well, you know, it's really kind of, he went out in the summer, it's kind of ugly. It's all dried up. It's all, you know, all yellow. And it's not pretty like Vermont. And I was just thinking, that ass. So, a couple weeks later, in August, I found myself in California. Came out there because my dad, you know, was ill. Everything turned out okay for him. And this poem kind of came to me, and I realized I'd been writing it. You know, when poets hear voices, it's because they've been working on something in their subconscious, and they haven't really let it come up to conscious, and it kind of comes through. And I didn't think anybody else would really like this poem. I was wrong. It was immediately sent, published by the New Yorker. It's been reprinted everywhere, and it's been translated into the language of every dry country. And it's about a Californian thinking of how an Easterner sees the landscape, and at the very end it turns into how we see it. California hills in August. I can imagine someone who found these fields unbearable, who climbed the hillside in the heat, cursing the dust, cracking the brittle weeds underfoot, wishing a few more trees for shade. An Easterner especially, who would scorn the meagerness of summer, the dry, twisted shapes of black elm, scrub oak, and chaparral, a landscape August already drained of green, one who would hurry over the clinging thistle, foxtail, golden poppy, knowing everything was just a weed, unable to conceive that these trees and sparse brown bushes were alive, and hate the bright stillness of the noon, without wind, without motion, the only other living thing, a hawk, hungry for prey, suspended in the blinding, sunlit blue. And yet, how gentle it seems to someone raised in a landscape short of rain, the skyline of a hill, broken by no more trees than one can count, the grass, the empty sky, the wish for water. Now, there's a section here called Song in this book, and the poems in it are really of two things. There's a kind of form in which a poem becomes more like a song, but there's also, I've also worked with about 20, 25 composers, songwriters, and so a lot of these were actually written to be set to music. And poetry and song are the same art. You know, it's the same rootstock. All poems in ancient cultures were sung and chanted. And I think that poetry, guys, there's a kind of energy when it, you know, it's the same thing. Our lives are more authentic when we actually acknowledge our relatives, you know, when we admit this is the lineage that we're from. So this is a song I wrote. I just finished a song cycle with the jazz pianist Helen Sung. And we were doing a jazz song cycle, and so this is the first one I wrote. And like a lot of songs, it uses slang. And this is a very L.A. poem. It's called Pity the Beautiful. Pity the beautiful. The dolls, the dishes, the babes with big daddies, granting their wishes. Pity the pretty boys, the hunks and the pollos, the golden lads whom success always follows, the hotties, the knockouts, the tens out of ten, the drop-dead gorgeous, the great leading men. Pity the faded, the bloated, the blousy, the paunchy Adonis whose locks turned lousy. Pity the gods, no longer divine. Pity the night. The stars lose their shine. There was there. If you don't like something, you should feel free to boo. You know, because frankly, I'm still trying to figure out what poems to read from the book in public. And if I get a little stinker, you know, you're probably doing me a favor to let me know. I talked to a woman right before the reading came, who's in this. She had to leave actually to go to choir practice. Who was singing Scala Cantorum down in the Santa Clara Valley, which and had performed this composer I wrote an opera for named Alva Henderson, and the first opera that we did was called Nosferatu, you know, and it's based, you know, on the vampire story. And it's very interesting when you write words to be set to music, you have different concerns than you do when you're just writing for the page. The first one is you can't make the text too complicated because somebody's got to set it to music. You know, it becomes, you know, you have to leave enough room where the composer can get in, you know, in through the mesh. Because you're, what you're doing with a poem is making a kind of fabric. And so the fabric can't be too tight. Secondly, the problem with singing is you can't always understand every word. So there's going to be a certain amount of attrition. And the way that songwriters have always dealt with this is to have parallel syntax. You have a sentence structure so that if you miss a word, you at least know, you know, subconsciously, you know, what kind of word you've met. But the third thing, those are fairly practical skills. The third thing is more mysterious. If you're creating a song, this is especially true in musical theater and opera, you've got to give somebody some words that let them know who they are, where they're from, what do they want, where are they going. So you not only give them a text, you have to give them a subtext. And this is really quite, I mean, playwrights understand this, screenwriters understand this, but, you know, it's not really part of your normal, you know, toolbox for a poet. And so this is the love song that the vampire, you know, gives to the woman that he's trying to court because she must come to him willingly. And so this, you know, raises the issue of, you know, what would make her want to come? And what he speaks to is the fact that he understands that there's kind of a darkness inside of her, a kind of unhappiness inside of her that she can't acknowledge. And he acknowledges this. He completes this. Generally, I should add, it's not probably generally good to follow the advice of the vampire. Nosferatu's Serenade. Once again, this is something that needs to be experienced off the page. Even for you, you should just listen to this one, if you can. I am the image that darkens your glass, the shadow that falls wherever you pass. I am the dream you cannot forget, the face you remember without having met. I am the truth that must not be spoken, the midnight vow that cannot be broken. I am the bell that tolls out the hours. I am the fire that warms and devours. I am the hunger that you have denied, the ache of desire piercing your side. I am the sin you have never confessed, the forbidden hand caressing your breast. You've heard me inside you speak in your dreams, sigh in the ocean, whisper in streams. I am the future you crave and you fear. You know what I bring. Now, I am here. You can already see that, you know, one of the things, about one third of my poems are in free verse, about one third are in meter without rhyme, about one third are rhymed and metrical. One of the things I really love is the noises that words make, you know, when you put them together. You know, my mother, you know, used to recite poems to me as, you know, as a kid. I mean, they would be, could be mellifluous, as, you know, it was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabelle Lee. Or they could be these things like Ogden Nash, you know. You know, a panther is like a leopard, except it hasn't been peppered. wonderful poem, which ends with some very good advice, which is, when called by a panther, don't answer. but the kind of thing, I mean, I really wish I could have been a poet, you know, in a high romantic age, you know, like Tennyson, where he could write a poem that goes, come into the garden, Maud, for the black bath night is flown. Come into the garden, Maud, I am here at the gate alone, and the spice of the woodbine is wafted aloft, and the musk of the rose is blown. I mean, wow, isn't that good stuff? My problem was that I, you know, usually had an office job, you know, and I didn't have many occasion to write in the high romantic mode. But a number of years ago, I came across a tragic love affair, and I felt that somebody should write about it. A friend of mine had a superannuated orange tabby cat named Fred, and she decided to brighten up his twilight years by bringing him home a child bride. And so she brought this young female cat to meet Fred, and the young cat was smitten by Fred, but it, in this May-December marriage, it proved too late in December for Fred to reciprocate. And so every month, the young cat would go into heat, chase Fred around the house and garden, but nothing ever happened. So I wrote her this poem. Come into the garden, Fred. To the neighborhood, tabby is gone. Come into the garden, Fred. I have nothing but my flea hauler on. The scent of the catnip is gone to my head. I'll wait by the screen door till dawn. The fireflies hoard in the sweet gum tree. A nightjar calls from the pine. And she seems to say in her rhapsody, oh, mustard brown Fred be mine. And the full moon sets my whiskers afire. And the fur goes erect on my spine. I hear the frogs in the muddy lake croaking from shore to shore. They have one swift season to soothe their ache. In autumn, they sing no more. So ignore me now, and you'll hear my meow as I scratch all night by the door. It now comes, you know, one of the dreaded moments in a poetry reading, which is inevitable, and there's no way, no escaping it, which is when, where the poet reads you a poem about writing poetry. You might, you know, this, in the excuse, this poem, I might say it's really a poem about not yet writing poetry. This is a poem in which I try to describe my ideal poem, which is not anything I've written to date, but it's the next poem that I'm going to write. And it's called The Next Poem. How much better it seems now than when it is finally done. The unforgettable first line, the cunning way the stanzas run. The rhymes, soft-spoken and suggestive, are barely audible at first, an appetite not yet acknowledged, like the inkling of a thirst, while gradually the form appears, as each line is coaxed aloud, the architecture of a room, seen from the middle of a crowd. The music, that of common speech, but slanted so that each detail sounds unexpected as a sharp inserted in a simple scale. No jumbled box of imagery dumped glumly on the reader's lap, or elegantly packaged junk the unsuspecting must unwrap, but words that could direct a friend precisely to an unknown place, those few unshakable details that no confusion can erase, and the real subject left unspoken, but unmistakable to those who don't expect a jungle parrot in the black and white of prose. How much better it seems now than when it is finally written. How hungrily one waits to feel the bright lure seized, the old hook bitten. The third section of my book is called Remembrance. The majority of those poems are in the memory of our first son, who died in 4 months of sudden infant death syndrome. I'm not going to read any of the poems that are about that experience or the aftermath, but I wanted to read one that's about an experience. I don't know if any of you have lost children or lost siblings, But there's something that happens, which is that ever thereafter, your child has a kind of phantom life. When you see a kid that would be about the same age as your son, you go, that's what my boy would be doing. That's what my boy, how big he'd be, what he would be like. And this is a poem called Majority that I wrote on what would have been my son's 21st birthday. Now you'd be 3. I said to myself, seeing a child born the same summer as you. Now you'd be 6 or 7 or 10. I watch you grow in foreign bodies, leaping into a pool, all laughter, or frowning over a keyboard. But mostly just standing, taller each time. How splendid your most mundane action seemed in these joyful proxies. I often held back tears. Now you are 21. Finally, it makes sense that you have moved away into your own afterlife. End with, three fairly short poems. Maybe not. This is one I don't know by heart, but I should, I guess. We were talking, Jack Stepan, our great local landscape painter, was raised in Yonkers in New York, and we were talking about an old estate that's there, called the old Untermeyer estate. There's a lot of these in the East where a rich person has this big, estate, and then usually the house falls, they can't pay the taxes, so they give it to the city, and some high school kid comes and burns the house down. But what you do have is a nice park. This is about, the park is a kind of landscape of the imagination. I think you can fill it in. The Lost Garden. If ever we see that garden again, if ever we see those gardens again, the summer will be gone. At least our summer. Some other mockingbird will concertize among the mulberries, and other vines will climb the high brick wall to disappear. How many footpaths cross that old estate? The gracious acreage of a grander age, so many trees to kiss or argue under, and greenery enough for any mood. What a pleasure to be sad in such surroundings, at least in retrospect, for even sorrow seems bearable when studied at a distance. And if we speak of private suffering, the pain becomes part of a well-turned tale, describing someone else who shares our name. Still, thinking of you, I sometimes play a game. What if we had walked a different path one day? Would some small incident have nudged us elsewhere, the way a pebble tossed into a brook might change the course 100 miles downstream? The trick is making memory a blessing, to learn by loss, subtraction of desire, of wanting nothing more than what has been, to know the past forever lost, yet seeing behind the wall a garden still in blossom. Now a really short poem. you know, if it's really short, you know, you got to give it a long explanation. I lied to you. There's going to be three more poems. And this one's kind of longish. Never trust a poet. I can't read my own notes. But you like this one. This is a poem that just came to me as a rhythm. Dum dum da dum 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 da dum dum da. And I couldn't figure out. I said words in it, so I wrote some words. Were mostly cliches, expressions of speech. But I figured it needed a story, and so I gave it a story. It's a story you all know. It's called Film Noir. It's a farm town in the August heat, with a couple of bars along Main Street. A jukebox moans from an open door, where a bored waiter sweeps the floor. A bus pulls up by Imperial Fruit. A guy gets out in a new prison suit. He's not bad-looking, medium height, full of ambition, not too bright. He's a lowlife, he's one of the lost, who's burnt every bridge he's ever crossed, just out of the slammer, a ticking bomb, the wrath of God and kingdom come. It's the long odds on a roll of the dice. For big stakes, you can't bet twice. The cards get dealt, the wheel spins. At the end of the night, the house always wins. He sees her alone at the end of the bar, smoking and hot like a fallen star. She's a cold beauty with a knowing wink. If she shot you dead, she'd finish your drink. Some guys learn from their mistakes, but all he learned was to raise the stakes. There's something he forgot in jail, that the female's deadlier than the male. It's tough love from a hard blue flame, and you can't beat a pro at her own game. It's the long odds, it's the old switcheroo. You think you're a player, but the mark is you. She's married, but lonely. She wishes she could. Wash your hands. Oh, that feels good. She whispers how much she needs a man. If only he'd help her. She has a plan. Their eyes meet, and he can tell. It's going to be fun, but won't end well. He prepares her plot with growing unease. She strokes his cheek, and he agrees. It's a straight shot. It's an easy kill. If he doesn't help her, some other guy will. It's a sleek piece with only one slug. Spin the chambers and give it a tug. The heat of her lips, the silk of her skin. His body ignites, he pushes in. They lie in the dark, under the fan. A sex-drunk chump. A girl with a plan. I'm going to end with the most recent poem in the book, and this is a poem about marriage or just long love. It's about, you know, when you have been with a person and have loved that person long enough, you begin, in a sense, to develop a private language. It's private language which doesn't even need words. And the metaphor that I end up using, it emerges only halfway in the poem, are these tribes where there might be only a few native speakers left. And when those speakers, you know, die, the language, the myths, the cults, and the rituals of the people are vanished with them. And I think that's what a marriage is like in some ways. You know, you've got, you know, you create this private culture. It's called Marriage of Many Years. Most of what happens, happens beyond words. The lexicon of lip and fingertip defies translation into common speech. I recognize the musk of your dark hair. I can't describe it. But it always thrills me. My finger on your thigh does not touch skin. It touches your sin, warming to my touch. You are a language I have learned by heart. This intimate patois will vanish with us. It's only native speakers. Does it matter? Our tribal chants, our dances round the fire, performed the sorcery we most required. They bound us in a spell time could not break. Let the young vaunt their ecstasy. We keep our tribe of two in solemn secrecy. It must be lost. Was never lost on us. Thank you so much.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. The majority of tonight's program that you just heard was Dana Gioia reading at the Word Temple Poetry Series in March of 2016. This was a very special evening celebrating his new position as California State Poet Laureate. Before signing off tonight, I want to let you know about the next event at the Word Temple Poetry Series that takes place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. It's this coming Saturday at 7 p.m., Saturday, May 21st, 7 p.m., and as usual, we have three poets that night. Sonoma County poet Julia Vos will open the evening. She's the author of Moved Out on the Inside. The two featured poets for the evening are Ada Limon. She's the author of four books of poetry, including Bright Dead Things, which was named a finalist for the 2015 National Book Award in Poetry and one of the top 10 poetry books of the year by the New York Times. Joining her is Gregory Marr. He is the he's a Sonoma County poet, and he is celebrating his first collection of poems. This is long overdue. We have been waiting for this. The book is called A Provisional Map of the Lost Continent. It was published by Fordham University Press and won the Poets Out Loud Prize. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.